Hey, deserving listeners, I thought I would answer some patron emails. This first email is from patron Marie from Seattle. She says, I loved your deep dive on apologies. I wish I had been more aware of how to apologize at the beginning of my relationship because it might have prevented my relationship from becoming toxic. I feel a sense of responsibility in the sense that I could maybe have prevented my partner from becoming abusive toward me. In your deep dive, you said that victims don't need to apologize to their abusers, but I would love to hear more about that. My abuser can't be the only one responsible for the failure of our relationship, right? I wish I could find the extent to which I am to blame because I don't want to be given a free pass and I'd like to grow from my mistakes, but where is the line? I listen to you a lot for about 2 years now and you have helped me to recover. End of email. Yeah, so difficult question to answer, obviously, but the landscape in the discourse that you will typically hear is that if you identify as a victim and it's believable, and I'm guessing that it is, then people around you, including some therapists, I suppose, will refrain from ever contemplating the notion that you might have been, quote unquote, to blame for some of the relationship dynamics. By the way, when I said to blame, I thought of to blame. I just rewatched Princess Bride. And I also watched the remake that was made during the pandemic where all these famous people recreated various different scenes from Princess Bride. If you've seen it, it's on the internet, YouTube. And I just love that movie so, so much. And I love the remake. I mean, some of it's a little slow. Anyway, so to blame and to blame. Okay, so there are two dimensions to consider, Marie. One is blame for the abuse, which you're never to blame for. And the other dimension is blame for the breakup. And there will be these two dimensions are at play, right? You broke up and there was abuse. When you talk about your circumstance, like I was saying earlier, a lot of people will not talk about you being to blame for the breakup because they really want to avoid blaming you for the abuse. And it's possible that the breakup was entirely due to the abuse. I don't know. But the way you phrase the question is wise in that you're saying, I wonder if we had a better way of apologizing. Well, actually, you said you feel like maybe you could have been better at apologizing. So I'm guessing that the abuse that you went through might have oriented your mind towards a more quick to blame yourself orientation. I don't know that, but what I would say is that if the two of you had better ways of managing your attachment and your reactivity and apologizing to each other, there's a better chance that things would have worked out and the abuse would have been mitigated. But that, of course, is not your fault. So that's mainly on your partner. But you ask like, well, where's the line between this? Because you also ask a wise question. You're basically saying, I don't want to just write off the whole thing in the past with this person I was with as being entirely their fault and I'm not to blame for anything. You're saying that you want to learn from this past relationship and you need to sift through what happened to determine like, well, what am I responsible for? Because I don't want those kinds of things to happen again. Even if my next relationship is not abusive, I certainly don't want it to go as poorly as it did. So how do I figure out the difference between abuse and what was just a dynamic that was built up between the two of us that I can work on my side of it? And the answer to that is therapy, because it's so complicated and even therapy wouldn't necessarily be able to figure it out, but it would be much better at exploring it because it's so nuanced and it depends on the way you frame it. Like if you were to talk with me and I detected that you were framing everything as if it were your fault, I would talk with you about that. Whereas if you were framing it as everything was always the other person's fault, then, you know, we'd talk about that. So it's not just the facts on the ground, because the facts on the ground are completely debatable based on your lens and your narrative. So, and also another question you can ask yourself, Marie, is as you're talking about the past and narrativizing it, ask yourself, if you heard a friend of yours that you cared about saying the same thing, what would you say to them? Because often for us, and particularly people who have been abused, they make an exception for themselves, but they don't make that exception for other people. For example, if you were to talk about the past, you're like, well, if only I had apologized better, maybe things wouldn't have gone down the path that it did. And then you imagine that you heard your friend saying that, and you think, oh, no. If you were good at apologizing, friend of mine, that I've externalized myself into my friend, this imaginary friend, if you were better at apologizing, that might have slowed down the abusive progression of abuse, but it wouldn't have stopped the abuse. I mean, your partner was determined to control you. Your partner had very odd attachment reactivity based on their childhood, and they refused to go to therapy. So it was just a matter of time. Sure, maybe if you apologized better, things would have been a little better, but it wouldn't have stopped the progression of the relationship. If anything, the fact that you weren't good at apologizing meant that it accelerated the end of the relationship, which you deserved to have accelerated, because the faster the better to get out of that thing. So I don't know the situation. As another example, one that I often talk about with clients is delineating between the attachment reactivity dynamic versus the rage or abusive control or coercion that your partner exhibited. So let's say that you are remembering an earlier interaction in your relationship before things got bad, and you're recalling that you hurt their feelings, your partner's feelings, because you didn't notice their feelings or you were upset about something else. And in that moment, it triggered something in your partner that led down a flow chart of emotions for your partner and interactions between the two of you that eventually led to a couple days later where your partner was being, let's say, verbally abusive and calling you names or something. And as you analyze that entire story, the end of that, or the where it got to for your partner, you are not to blame for. You're not to blame for your partner converting all of that hurt that they felt into rage and control and abuse to you. That is completely not your fault. You could argue that it is your responsibility, and this is something you can learn from in the future relationships. In the very beginning of that interaction, as you were not noticing your partner's feelings, or maybe not attuning to their feelings, or not acknowledging them, or being threatened by your partner's feelings or something, that's a more mundane relational dynamic that happens in all relationships, whether it's abusive or not abusive. And that part you can look at, but you're not responsible for your partner converting all that pain into abuse. I hope that's one example that you can look at. Also, notice how I word it. I don't word it like you are to blame for him being hurt. I'm saying you are responsible for noticing or doing your best to notice attachment reactivity and how you communicate and attunement, in the same way that your partner was responsible for you in that way. Now, you're not responsible for your partner being hurt. You're not to blame for them being hurt, unless it was obviously hurtful, like you just come in the house randomly one day after work and you just start calling them your partner names or something. But that usually isn't the case, right? So your partner's hurt is probably mostly due to their attachment injuries earlier in life. A little bit of hurt probably was justified, but the amount of hurt that they felt, and then of course how they converted all that hurt into anger, that's not your fault. But a little bit of it is. So that's just. But again, you would really have to sift through this with a therapist. All right, this next email is from annual patron Will from Fort Wayne. He says, "Hello, my friend Lacey Johnson and I are tremendous fans. We are both finishing our first semester of practicum as a therapist and would really appreciate any encouragement from you. Well, Will and Lacey, congratulations. Welcome to the field. It is a noble profession, if I don't say so myself. And I can't imagine the amount of imposter syndrome you're going through right now, because I've never met a non-narcissistic, well, I don't know. I'm guessing you're experiencing a lot of imposter syndrome. And I hope that you support each other, and I hope you have a good supervisor who props you up. Okay, you have a question. My question for you is this. What do you do when a client says something shocking in session? What do you do when a client says something shocking in session? Do you conceal your reaction for fear of placing more shame on them? Do you non-verbally express surprise because you want to be congruent? Obviously, this is circumstantial, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this from multiple perspectives. End of email. Yeah, I love this question because it's a very important question for therapists to consider. And it's very important, particularly for novice clinicians. And I cannot summarize my entire view on this because it's so subtle and complicated and also nonverbal. When I talk with novice therapists about this, I have to observe them because we're not great at cataloging our own responses nonverbally to our clients. I, for example, will occasionally videotape myself in session, and I'm shocked at how different I look compared to what I think I am looking like. And so over time, I have learned to change how I behave in terms of nonverbals, like my facial expressions, my body posture, my hand movements, this sort of thing. I have changed it to match what I intend. It's weird, right? Like even with my reaction videos, I've done this. That when I first started making react, you know, nothing. So when I first started the podcast, I had never heard my voice so often. You know, whenever you hear your voice, maybe it's different now because there's so much recording going on. But in the past, there was so little recording, audio and visual of people, that when we all heard ourselves or saw ourselves, we're like, is that what I look like? Is that what I sound like? That sounds so weird. My voice sounds so strange. And it would be, it would create a cognitive dissonance for people that they wouldn't want to hear their voice recorded because of how foreign it sounded. Because to us, when we hear our voice, we hear not only what everyone else hears, but we also hear the rattling of our own skull. You know, when you are talking, it the sound wave comes out of your mouth and creates this, you know, series of shock waves that go from my whole face. Actually, our whole face radiates sound, our sinuses, everything. And that sounds a certain way, you know, like when I hear other people on audio recordings, they sound the same to me because the microphone and I are hearing, you know, a very similar thing. But to us, we hear that. And we also hear the rattling of our own skull. You know, I don't know the exact term, but the point is that when I first started recording the podcast and I edit these things pretty closely, I got used to my voice and I started hearing all these annoying quirks in my speaking voice that I trained myself out of because I was so annoyed with myself when I would listen back. And I wasn't annoyed with myself when I was talking, but I was very annoyed when I would listen back. Similarly, with reaction videos, I started making those in earnest a few years ago, and I edit those all pretty carefully as well. And when I watch myself, I look at and I'm like, what is wrong with my hair? Why did I make that face? What am I doing with my hands? That shirt looks like I pulled it out of the gutter. What's wrong with me? But before that point, I was a late 40s. I was probably 49 when I first started. The pandemic started, I was 49. And 49 years, you'd think that I would know how I look and how I'm coming across, right? Especially as a professor and as a podcaster and a therapist and as a husband, and, you know, you just think I would have some grasp of how I'm communicating and what I'm doing, but I was astonished at what was happening. You know, even with my hair, for example, I would look at myself in the mirror in the morning and sort of, you know, I would come out of the shower and I would just comb it back or something. And I would look at myself in the mirror and I'd go, yeah, it looks great. And I'd go on with my day. But then there's something different seeing it on video. Because I think mirrors aren't a great representation of how we are as humans. Because I would see this very different hair situation. And then the pandemic happened and I couldn't go to the hair cutter and I was cutting my own hair, which was a disaster, and I couldn't cut the back of my head. So I had this very strange haircut, and every 6 months Stacy would cut the back of my head and she was very nervous about doing it and she didn't know what she was doing, but it was the pandemic, so I didn't really care. But anyway, point is that I would record myself and I would be astonished as how I was coming across. Long story short, one of the main things I learned was that I tended to have very little reactions in my face and body, even though I felt like I was having big, big reactions. So I learned I need to adopt a new pattern of how I react that's more accurate with what I'm trying to convey. So that's one thing to think about is not only what do you do when a client says something shocking, like you're asking Will and Lacey, but also just know that you have to get to know who you are. I've thought early in my career, I had this realization that being a therapist is kind of like being an actor or a performer. You're not acting, you're not performing, right? You have empathy, but you need to convey empathy very clearly to a wide range of humans with different cultural notions of communication and that sort of thing. And so especially for me, because growing up in my family, I wasn't really required to be that spokesperson for the family, because, you know, I had my parents who were both pretty talkative, my mom in particular, and extroverted. My older brother and sister are very social. And then there was me, 7 years younger, and I was always in my own world, partially, I think, because my older brother and sister just took up so much space, you know, verbally and emotionally. Not in a bad way, but I just was fine in my own head, I guess. And I think I neurologically developed this subdued reactivity. And there were reports from my aunts and uncles and other people in my family that would say that when I was young, like 3 or 4 years old, I looked like I was just observing everything quietly. and I think it was because I just learned that there wasn't really much point in trying to convey emotion and stuff, because there was just a lot of chaos going around. Not bad chaos. Anyway, the point is that I think that I had a very subdued way of non-verbalizing. And so I have to perform how I feel on the inside, which means that I have to act in a way that feels a little foreign to me. And maybe over time I develop a new habit. For example, I'm not sure about this, but in my reaction videos, I was, you know, editing one recently, and I noticed that I'm doing a lot of nonverbals in the video. and I'm thinking, oh boy, it seems a little over the top. But so maybe I'll tone it down a little bit. But I think I started developing that because in my reaction videos, you only see my shoulders and my head. And so I have to put a lot of emotion into that small space or something. And as I'm trying to explain things, I think I've adopted a semi-gregarious way of swinging my arms around or something. I don't know, for better or for worse. And I think it's because of this phenomenon that I learned I needed to amp it up a little bit because I was actually trying to convey that. Also, as a professor, you're constantly trying to keep your students awake because our classes at Antioch are 3 hours long, and I have to stand in front of 16 people, sometimes at 9 p.m. at night. Some classes were from 7 to 10 p.m., which for some people is way past their bedtime, right? And it's very disheartening to watch students start to nod off. And so I learned I had to be very big with my movements and my communication, which really lent itself to being a podcaster, I think. Anyway, getting to your question though, what do you do when a client says something shocking in session? And what I'll say is that there's so many things to say. This is just my take, and it's reflective of my style and also what I think therapists should do. But is it empirically what therapists should do? No. You could find another professor or supervisor who has a different style that works for them that would say things differently. So take what I say with that in mind. And for me, I tend, especially when a client says something quote-unquote shocking, well, okay, so there's two categories that I'll say of shocking content. One is that a client says something like, so last night I had sex with 3 different people. And you say it's the first session, and you don't know this client at all. So for a lot of people, culturally speaking, that would be a very shocking thing to say, right? If you went to brunch with some people at work and you said, last night I had sex with 3 people at the same time, that would be culturally shocking, but it's not actually a problem. Now, it could be a problem. The client might say after that, and I don't want to do that sort of stuff. But it's not baseline a problem that they had sex with 3 people last night. So I will try to break my supervisees, my trainees, of having that cultural reactivity to clients, because you could really shame people. What if they're polyamorous? What if they have 3 husbands? And they say, I had sex with 3 men last night while my kids were sleeping in the other room. At a brunch, you're going to get a bunch of gasps, right? But if you gasp as a therapist to that, you could really harm the client and the therapy. And that is not okay, right? You need to clamp down on that and stop that shit. And so it's normal to come into a program, into becoming trained as a therapist, to have those tendencies, but you gotta rein that in, because there's so many cultural things that you will hear, especially as clients open up to us, that you cannot just go, it's really harmful. It'll shut a client down. I've heard so many stories from clients and friends of mine that will say that they said something along these lines and the therapist gasped, and you can't put that toothpaste back in the tube. Once you gasp, even if as a therapist, you do everything you can to make up for it, it's always going to raise a question to the client as to whether or not you can be trusted as a safe person to say things to. So that's one category of shocking. The other category of shocking is, say that the client says, and this is a client that, say, you know pretty well, and they say, oh my God, last night I had sex with my husband. Okay. And you know that they haven't had sex in 2 years and they're really trying to, you know, spark their sexuality in the marriage again. And the clients, and you've been talking with your client a lot about sex, and maybe at a certain point, it just seemed like it was off the table, that they were just never going to have sex again. And your client sits down and says, me and my husband, we had sex last night. Well, that's another category of shocking that might actually, it would harm a client if you didn't react to that, right? So in those situations, you might be serving the client best if you actually go with your internal shock and convey congruent, shocking nonverbals and go, oh my God, you know. And if you don't do that, if you're like, tell me more, then that might actually hurt the client, because the client could walk away thinking that you don't care or that you don't understand the weight of the situation or that you're not listening or you're not invested or something. So there's various different types of shocking material. And what I find is a lot of trainees will have a really hard time figuring out the difference between culturally shocking and actually shocking, right? Or if a client were to say, oh my God, last night, Child Protective Services contacted me and said that I was accused of having abused my students at school, you know, say they're a teacher. So that's both a culturally shocking thing and an actually shocking thing that a therapist should react to, I think. Now, how do you react? Again, that's a style thing. You know, some people will be very reactive and some people will be more subdued. And, you know, there are different styles of therapy toward the psychoanalytic, classic psychoanalytic side where they really refrain from reacting, to more humanistic, more genuine, gestalt-y kind of forms of therapy where congruence is very important, right? So it really just runs the gamut. But it's important for therapists to really investigate for themselves when they're novices and really throughout their career to figure out where they are on that spectrum and what sort of content is it that feels shocking to them but isn't actually shocking. Like the first example I gave of I had sex with three different men last night. That's not actually shocking. It's different. And if you watch my reaction videos, you might notice that I don't tend to react to things very often, even though they're reaction videos. But I don't tend to go, oh my God, you know, I don't clutch my pearls because I disabused myself of a lot of the notions of cultural shock throughout my career. And I think I just have always been this way since I was young. The only thing I can point to is that as a half Japanese person who in the 70s would eat raw fish and all the white people around me would clutch their pearls, I would be like, what do you think? Raw fish? It's fine. You know, now I know for all y'all, you probably had sushi and love it, but when I was a kid and really even I'm guessing until 95 or something, eating sushi was not only just an Asian thing, it was a Japanese thing. I mean, Koreans and Chinese people would make fun of me. Although Chinese and Koreans have their own things that Japanese people would react to. But the point is that I think that's maybe where it comes from. But I think it's really important to be able to, you know, if you decide to be, I say this on a number of levels for trainees. I say the first day of class, I'll tell them, there was you before you entered class today. And now you have to adopt a new way of thinking, a new persona, a new self to some extent. In the past, you could have all these notions of shock and bias and hatred towards particular groups of people, whether you call it that or not. You know, before you walked in that door, you can hate Republicans. Now you cannot do that anymore. You can hate their ideals. You can hate the way that they vote, but you can't hate actual Republicans. You can't even hate Republican politicians because they will come in your door. I have treated Republican politicians in my career. And, you know, and through those relationships, hour by hour, every week, month by month, year by year, it just realigns the bones in my body toward a more open, loving, accepting way. I don't have room in the office, just me and that person. It's not going to work if I'm going to continue to hate this group of people or have bias against them. You know, there's good and wonderfulness and love and glory in every human being on this planet. And once you become a therapist, then in my book, that is the way, to quote The Mandalorian, that is the way. And before you were a therapist, you know, you're free to be a regular human. And a part of this is that once you walked in that door to become a therapist, you cannot just freewheel your, is that the phrase? You can't just be a freewheeling reactor of life. You can't just be shocked at whatever feels shocking to you based on how things feel to you. You have to investigate those things and be careful with how you react, because you could destroy someone with a gasp. All right, let's take a break. All right, we're back from the break. Let's do an OPP. These people became patrons all the way back in 2021. These are all annual patrons. We have Raquel from Iceland. We have Nobuko from Australia. We have Katie from Chicago. We got Leslie from Connecticut. Pew Yi from Hong Kong. Josh from Ontario, Canada. Franzi from London. Carrie from Mayflower, Arkansas, it looks like. We have Kenish from South Carolina. North Charleston. Is that near actual Charleston? It seems like. Charleston's a beautiful city. Bronwyn from Michigan. Bronwyn, so I feel like there's been a few Bronwyns that I have interacted with, some more than others, and I feel like I just know you as Bronwyn, but do I know which Bronwyn it is? I feel like I should note those things. Emma from Olympia, good old Olympia, Washington, the capital of Washington State. Lucy from San Fran. Tarnassa from Santa Clara. Orla from Ireland, Dublin, Ireland. Kathleen, good old Orla. Kathleen from Georgia. And Shannon and Juliana from God knows where. Thank you for becoming a patron and staying a patron through thick and thin. Right, next emails from annual anonymous patron. She says, I am curious about your thoughts on why men abandon their families only to start a family with someone else shortly after leaving. About 3 years ago, my ex, the father of my sons, went for a walk one night and never came home again. I have been going through the divorce process for the last 3 years. He has made the process difficult, expensive, and contentious by filing motions and contempt charges against me. Meanwhile, throughout this ordeal, he has moved in with a woman who lives across the street from our sons and me. He just had a baby with her, his fourth child, with his third woman. My sons and I are struggling to make sense of his behavior, and why on earth would he start a family with someone who lives across the street from us? Additionally, he hasn't paid consistent support for the past 3 years except for my rent. End of email. Well, patron, I am so sorry you're going through this. This is one of the worst things you can go through in life as a human being. You are a parent. You love your kids, your boys. You also were in love with your ex in the past. And to have your ex just walk out the door, abandon you, which hurts, obviously, and is obviously also very inconvenient, financially, right, and destructive. But the prime directive of a parent is to take care of your children, and to have your children suffer because of what he is doing. It's one thing for a deadbeat dad, as they call them, to only show up once a month or every other month or something like that. It's another thing for them to just completely disappear and to be so callous as to move in right across the street where your boys can maybe see him coming and going. I mean, the trauma that your children are going through is just tremendous. And so I'm really sorry for that. And all the stress that you're going through with him, filing different legal things against you. I've been with people as they go through this. It's just a constant, set of thorns in your side, right? It's a constant stress, a constant cloud hanging over you. And you're just trying to do good by your boys. You're trying to move on with your life. And it's the worst. But your question is as to why some... Now, you frame it as men, and of course, statistically, it is more men that do this, but women do this too, for sure. And I've had people in my personal life and clients who have had mothers that would just disappear like this. So it's people that do this. Again, many more men do it. But you ask, you know, why do parents do this? And it's, there's a lot of different possible reasons. I mean, one, we could just throw out the psychopathy angle and just say that the individual just doesn't have empathy, but that's not usually the case. My top hypothesis, given what you are saying, without more information, of course, is, you know, the first thing that I would investigate is that the parent who did the abandoning had their own massive attachment injuries when they were young, whether they talked about it or even knew about it consciously or not. And they're just recreating it. It happens all the time. There are people that are very hurt by parents that abandon them and abuse them when they were young. And then they grow up to repeat the same thing, even though they vowed they never would do that to anybody. So that would be the first candidate. And in all likelihood, what happened, I don't know, but the typical scenario is that he entered the relationship genuinely wanting to be a good husband and father, but given his traumas, he was prone to being overly hurt, exaggeratedly hurt, but also would avoid those feelings and maybe even go into denial of them, turn to escapism, avoidance, maybe even drug abuse, and running away. So, you know, that's a very common story. I'm not saying you're supposed to have sympathy for the asshole, but I'm just saying that that's a possible reason as to why it would happen. Another reason worth mentioning as a possibility is sexism, that for many men, they are programmed to believe that parenting and housework and that sort of stuff is not their responsibility, and their slave wives are supposed to be doing all that for them. And they might have had that modeled to them. So they think, well, I mean, you know, who cares? You know, because parenting is, what's so weird about it, of course, you know this, patron, is that how as a parent could you just run away from your kids? The compulsion to love and to be there for your children is so strong. How could someone, there's probably not enough money in the world that someone could pay you to abandon your children willingly like that, right? So it's bizarre. There's got to be something going on there, right? And I've treated men like this who, deep down, they are deeply ashamed and they deeply miss their children, but they, to a much larger extent, are terrified of emotion and of vulnerability and of being attached and being hurt by their partner. So they would rather forego that need of connection to their children than face what they believe to be an insurmountable mountain of pain and vulnerability and emotion. And so when I work with them and I show them it's really the opposite, that the love in their heart is so big and so pronounced and their fears of vulnerability are overblown, then, you know, things can often realign themselves. All right, this next email deals with sexual assault, not in detail, but the topic. So if you want to skip over that due to it being triggering to you regarding your traumas and distress, skip forward 15 minutes or so. Anonymous YouTube member wrote in, she said, "Hi, Kirk, can you talk about why it's a common reaction for rape and sexual abuse victims to feel guilty and responsible for what happened to them? I wasn't raped, but I experienced a sexual partner violating my boundaries, and then he blamed it on me. I felt overwhelming shame and guilt and had to sleep with the covers between my legs in a silly attempt to protect myself. It would be very interesting for me if you shed a light on why victims react this way." End of email. Okay, so let's sift through this email that you're saying, anonymous YouTube member. You say, "I wasn't raped, but I experienced a sexual partner violating my boundaries and then he blamed me." So I don't know what that, I don't need to know exactly what that means, but if I were to answer this question in a way that was in the direction of what you're dealing with, I would have to know at least I would need to know more information, because from the way you word it, it sounds very much like somebody did something to you that was obviously something you didn't want to have happen, either explicitly or implicitly, and then you communicated that it harmed you or you didn't like it, and then your partner blamed you for it in a very unfair way. And that sounds really awful. I'm sorry that happened to you. That can be very damaging and traumatic even. So there's that possibility. But there's another possibility based on the way you worded it, that it was some sort of boundary violation and you experienced some level of distress, and then the communication between you and your partner didn't go that well, and he blamed you for it. But if we had all the details, we would see it more as a nuanced situation. That doesn't really change my response that much now that I say it out loud. But the way you word it, it sounds more like the former, where there was an obvious boundary violation and he didn't care or care to think about that sort of thing, or has been indoctrinated in a certain way and forged ahead. And then afterwards, because of his programming, he listens to a lot of Andrew Tate, or he's just a jerk face. He blames you for something that was completely not your fault. Obviously, that's what it sounds like to me. And then you say you felt overwhelming shame and guilt, and you're wondering why that is. Well, I find that a lot of people today will ask me these sorts of questions because they intellectually know better. You know, they're surprised. From an early age, they might have absolutely known that it's not the victim's fault and that victim blaming is bad. And yet, after an incident like this, they will blame themselves and they'll think, how is this happening? I knew that I should. So what's going on here? How come I have all these intrusive thoughts? And it's one thing to intellectually understand something. It's another thing to be that thing. You know, you can know, for example, that you are you're a worthwhile human being, and that you deserve love, and that you deserve to feel good about yourself. But at the same time, have a lot of intrusive thoughts that are saying otherwise, right? So I don't know if that's what you're dealing with, but the way you worded it kind of sounds like maybe you're in that camp. And it's great that you have that intellectual foundation to be able to combat this, but it's not strange to me that you have this overwhelming emotion and overwhelming shame, because we are not even close to being out of the woods yet as a society when it comes to sexism and victim blaming and sex shaming. We have a very robust culture of sex shame and sex negativity and victim blaming and emotion blaming, I guess we can add that as well, that is in our bones. And when we go through things like this, then all those intrusive voices, all those internalized voices become intrusive thoughts. And it produces a lot of distress that can't be eliminated by an intellectual understanding otherwise. So I'm really sorry you went through that. And you know, this other sentence you say, I feel overwhelming shame and guilt and had to sleep with the covers between my legs in a silly attempt to protect myself. That word silly is an internalized voice of some sort. No one resorts to that kind of behavior for silly reasons. You did that because your body and mind and soul needed to do that, and probably much more than that. But you didn't feel okay or safe or worthy to be able to truly get yourself to a safe situation. And that's one thing I just want to really emphasize, is that if you ever, for any reason, all y'all out there, if you don't feel safe, you deserve to feel safe. You don't necessarily deserve to bother everyone around you. Now, in this situation with this member, obviously, she can bother her partner, for example, like, get out of my house, or I love you. You know, if, I don't know if they're, it says sexual partner, so I don't know if they're in a relationship, but I can't sleep with you in this room anymore because I am in a lot of distress because of what happened and blah, 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 or whatever. You know, you deserve to. But say you walk into a grocery store and you're having a panic attack because of traumas that you've been through in your childhood, you don't have the human right to be able to shut the entire grocery store down and make everyone get out, right? But you do have the right to do what you can to be safe. And it's such a huge oppressive notion in our society that if you don't feel safe, then that's on you and you're a crybaby. You know, a classic example of claustrophobia is sitting in the middle seat of an airplane or sitting in a middle seat in a row in the movie theater or at a play or something. And not everyone with claustrophobia experiences this, but they often do. And so they want to sit in the aisle seat. And so many people that suffer from this, because I used to suffer from it, I don't anymore. I could easily slip back into that if I don't watch my P's and Q's regarding my habituation and my internal cognitive therapy that I do to myself. But a lot of people with this will have this problem, and it's completely legit. But because of our society, if you were to say, hey, you know, say, for example, you are going on an airplane trip. That's a funny phrase, airplane trip. And for whatever reason, as you're getting on the plane, they say, oh my God, we're so sorry. We had to switch your seat to a middle seat. And so suddenly you're sitting in the middle. And so many people in that situation will do anything other than ask for help with that. They will sit in the middle seat and just cry themselves the whole way on the airplane trip, or they'll just cancel the flight or something. Whereas what they deserve to be able to assert or ask for is to say, hey, I have a condition that makes it so that I freak out when I sit in the middle seat. I'm sorry that I have this condition. I'm working on it, but it'll completely give me a lot of emotional distress if I'm in that middle seat. So is there a possibility that you can switch me to an aisle seat? Because I need that aisle seat. Or once you get to the row, you talk to the person in the aisle seat and you say, I'm so sorry. I have this thing called claustrophobia. And if I sit in the middle seat, I know it's weird, but if I sit in the middle seat, I will freak out. And I'm so sorry. Do you mind if we switch and you sit in the middle? I swear to God, if you got to go to the bathroom, I will pop up and I'll be your best friend. Can I sit in the aisle? You absolutely have the right to ask for those things because you deserve to be safe. You deserve to take actions to be safe. So if you're sitting there at night with your, you know, covers between your legs because you're attempting to protect yourself because you don't know what else to do, that is not silly. That is your human right, my friend. You have the right to be able to do what you can do to make yourself feel safe. You did not feel safe. You did not feel safe for a very, very good reason, even though 90% of our society would think you were being silly. But we all understand that society is not smart. The rest of our society is not a good guide for what is wise, right? So fuck society and tell yourself that you deserve to be safe. All right, let's take a break. All right, back from the break. Let's do another OPP. These people started as patrons in 2021. We have Louise and Cha, who are annual deserving listeners from God knows where. We have the following annual upper tier or middle tier patrons. We have M from Ozone Park, New York. Ozone Park, New York. That sounds like something from sci-fi. We have Kim from Scottsdale, Arizona. Kim, is that the Kim? We have Tiki from Seattle. I know where that is. Maria from Spokane, upper tier, middle tier patron, annual Maria from Spokane, which is where my family's from. And we have Heidi from God knows where. And the following are monthly, just regular patrons. We have Patricia from Poland, Shamana from Pennsylvania, Ivy from Arkansas, G's from Berlin, Germany, Amy from Boulder, Colorado, where Mork from Work was from. I used to love that show when I was a kid. Louisa from Brentwood, Great Britain. Amy from Brentwood, California. That's funny. And Sarah from Buffalo, New York. Thank you for being a patron and staying a patron through thick and thin. All right, this next email is from anonymous patron. She says, after over a decade of chronic illness as a young person, I've found myself extremely alone. I have severe insomnia that is very resistant to treatment, with typical approaches focused on anxiety like CBT or ACT or mindfulness or relaxation training. It feels like my body just can't sleep because the level of social isolation is making my body feel too afraid and alone to let my guard down enough to sleep. From my research, it seems there are some studies finding correlations between loneliness and sleep issues, but not yet any research on the directionality of that association or treatment for these issues. I'm wondering if I'm missing something. End of email. Okay, yeah. So, absolutely. And it doesn't take a genius to draw those connections, that, especially with the way you phrase it, right? That, you know, you understand, I don't need to repeat this, but I'll say the topic sentence, that we are social creatures, like possibly one of the most social creatures on the planet. We biologically are designed to orient ourselves towards other human beings such that we need them in the same way that we need to have water and fiber and calories and sunlight and, you know, safety. We need other human beings. We need relationships, maybe even to the point where we need their physical warmth. We need to be near them. We need to cuddle and touch and feel that safety and that intimacy. So to be isolated is going to cause a lot of problems, not just with sleep, but all sorts of problems have been measured. And all those other problems that we've measured, like distress and depression and anxiety, absolutely can affect sleep and make it difficult to fall asleep. You say that you suffer from social isolation and it makes your body feel too afraid and too alone to let your guard down enough to sleep. You're in a constant state of fear because you're alone, which makes total sense. And you don't have to look far in the research to find that. The problem is that our society is so backward that not only do they ignore loneliness, but they also ignore sleep issues. You look online when you have a sleep problem, or you go to a therapist or a physician, the kind of advice you get, it's not bad advice, but it's not universally effective. The road to insomnia, the roads to insomnia are in the billions. There's so many possibilities as to why someone would suffer from insomnia. And you're not going to get a lot of good information out there, right? They're going to route you towards CBT or mindfulness or relaxation or... when you say it the way you do, those things are those would be the things I would recommend. So the fact that they haven't worked... Well, you see, you haven't really said you tried them. You have severe insomnia that is very resistant to treatment. Oh, okay. Well, what sort of treatment have you done? Have you done it with actual clinicians that know what they're doing, or have you not? But even with that, because even if you got rid of a bit of the anxiety, it wouldn't take away the loneliness that is fueling the anxiety, right? And even if you didn't have anxiety, you would still feel the loneliness and the distress of that, right? So, and there's no amount of cognitive therapy that can take away the fact that you are lonely, right? We can't sit there and say, well, you just have to have a lot of positive thoughts and say that everything's okay. It's sort of like if your house is burning down and you're having trouble sleeping, you can't in your mind say, well, everything's going to be fine, because everything isn't fine. Your house is burning down. Everything isn't fine. You're lonely. So there's not much you can do to counteract the reality of that. And this is a general rant for everyone out there that suffers from sleep problems. I've worked with a lot of clients on it. I've had my own problems with sleep over the years. And what I'll say is to keep working on it and don't give up and don't accept these simplistic explanations and treatment modalities if they don't work. Give it a try. Relaxation can absolutely help. And mindfulness. But what I do with clients in this area is, and I do this for myself, is what are you thinking about? What are the patterns of thinking that you have throughout the day, but also when your head hits the pillow? Because if your pattern of thinking engages certain aspects of your mind, it will make it very difficult to fall asleep. Whereas if you allow those areas of your mind to relax a little bit, you know, like for me, right now, Stacy and I were taking these pottery classes. And last night, I found that if I thought about the next pottery project I wanted to work on, I fell asleep very quickly. Whereas if I thought about other things, it would kind of keep my mind abuzz such that I wouldn't fall asleep. And I noticed last night that I did it several times because, you know, I'd wake up and then I would start thinking about something and then I'd, okay, go back to my pottery thing and then I would fall asleep like almost immediately. I could feel myself as I'm thinking about pottery falling. And then in the morning I woke up and I thought, you know, I thought about pottery like 3 or 4 times last night, but I think I only got to like step 2 in the project before my mind fell asleep. Now, I'm not saying that thinking about pottery is going to cure your insomnia, but there's just a lot of different angles to it, and it can be complicated. And just saying to yourself that you're not going to think about distressing things is easier said than done for a lot of people, right? So, you know, it could be quite comprehensive in terms of the amount of things that you're tackling. So anyway, my point is that for everyone out there who have sleep problems is to value yourself. You deserve to sleep. You deserve to have people value how important it is to sleep. You deserve to have someone there or everyone to reflect to you just how horrible it is to not be able to sleep. I feel like I don't know if it's derived from when we're younger and we can get by on less sleep at times, but I think that's a myth as well. In my society and mainstream American society, I just feel like sleep is this thing that's seen as weak. You know, like there are times when I really want to sleep in the morning because I just really want to be able to sleep. And I have found that some people react to that as if I'm being lazy or something. And I'm just like, am I a lazy person? Do I look lazy to you? I'm not. People don't usually think of me as lazy, right? And yet I love to sleep and value it greatly and need it, right? And consider it to be a very nourishing thing. And I've even organized my life right now such that I don't have an alarm anymore. I don't schedule anything for the morning because I want to be able to wake up when I wake up. And that has really improved my life. Now when I do have an appointment like our pottery class, which is in the morning, I have to set my alarm, which can kind of screw me up for the day. Not always, but point is that you deserve to sleep. You deserve to have people value your sleep. You deserve to have people say, oh my God, like you're not sleeping well. How are you managing? That's so horrible. Cause it is, it's horrible. You could argue it's more important than eating. Like you can go without eating for a while. I don't recommend it, but from what I understand, you can go without eating for a while. You can't go without sleeping for a while. You'll start to lose your mind. You'll start to hallucinate. You won't be able to think straight. You won't be able to do anything. You won't even be able to get food, right? Your entire process will shut down and you'll be dead in no time, right? Not to freak people out, but sleep is very, very, very important. And not only just sleep, but good sleep. Because if you take medications to sleep, sometimes, yeah, you'll be unconscious, but you won't actually be going into the necessary rhythms of sleep that actually nourish the mind and the body. When I read your email, it just gets me upset that what I think is happening to you is you're running into the very typical, well, maybe there's three levels to it. There, often the first dumb layer in people's responses or the way the internet will react will give very trite advice, like, you know, make sure your room is quiet. It's like, well, no duh. But some people need to be told that, right? You know, very simplistic sleep hygiene kind of things. And then the next layer, if you're lucky, someone will start recommending more in-depth treatment things like CBT and mindfulness and stuff. But even that, it's like hard to know if they know what they're doing. And that's great, but it's not the end of the deal. The next layer where I'm at in my life is, and when people come to me, is I sit down and I say, well, first off, let me just validate your feelings because it's horrible to have these kinds of issues. And also, I'm here to tell you that, you know, we'll start with these easy things, but we might find ourselves going down hundreds of different roads to figure out if something's going to work for you. There's so many things that can get in the way. And when I talk to people about it, they all have their own solution because that's what works for them. And they think that that works for everybody. But in my experience, any particular solution is not likely to work for the next person because everyone's road to insomnia or sleep deprivation is different, or is, you know, at least potentially different. And everyone's road to recovery is also potentially different. So I feel bad for you. But the thing to do is to just keep working on it is what I want to tell everyone, is don't give up. And if one physician or one therapist or one website or one treatment thing that you're trying isn't working, don't stop there. Just keep going down all the roads, keep asking more physicians, more second opinions, reading research, experimenting with different things for yourself, because there might be a set of solutions out there that are not typical to people, and thus you need to uncover a lot of rocks before you get there. All right. Well, that does it for that episode in which I read patron emails. If you want to submit an email, you want to go to the website and fill out the form there. And remember that the vast majority of emails I never get to. So I deeply, deeply apologize for that. I am actually contemplating, I don't know if you heard the episode where I talked about AI, and it's possible that I might be able, you know, sometimes people will ask, you know, Kirk, what would you, what if you could clone yourself, what would you have your clone do? You know, like if, what would you wish you could get done if you had a clone? And one of the clones that I would love to give them a full-time job is to respond to all the emails, because I feel guilty when I don't. And I also really just love reading all the emails. So I, one of the ways of getting a clone is maybe to have an AI version of me, which sounds like ridiculous and unethical possibly. And of course I'm going to consider all those angles, but I am tempted if it works right and it is ethical and it is something that is accurate. I think, you know, it could be something that would make it so I could sleep better at night, speaking of. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, really do.